This is KHOI Community Radio, where we explore the people, stories, and events in our seven-county listening area in central Iowa. I am one of your hosts for today, Susan Franzen, together with my co-host, Paul Wearson. Hello, Paul.
Well, hello, Susan. Finally, it's warm, and we've had some much-needed rain, but I can do without all the warnings and my radio going off all the time with all this excitement in the sky, but thank God for the rain. It's nice, and also the temperature is reasonable. I didn't wear a jacket today.
Yes, it feels like spring with buds popping, wildflowers in the woods, bulbs in the gardens, and the white flowers of the northern magnolia. So it's a good time to talk about celebrations. This upcoming weekend, of course, will be a big time of celebration for many in our listening area with graduation at ISU. DMAC Metro, including Ankeny, will hold graduation ceremonies tonight, May 2nd. The Boone DMAC campus will hold theirs on May 5th.
Yeah, there are a lot of graduation parties in high schools. I go to, Roland Story is my school district, so I'll go to several graduation parties. And I'm in the Pen Pal program for RSVP, where we write to students throughout the year. And then there's the culmination at the end, where you actually meet the students. So we're having those parties now in May, too.
Even fifth graders. Our program today continues the story of the Decorah Eagles, with nature reporter Pat Schlarbaum telling people about today's memorial service for Decorah Dad and the tributes sent by people from around the country. My husband Fritz and I celebrated spring with a road trip to rural Boone County, from Red Granite Farm to Whatchasmokin' in Luther. On a historical note, Boone City Councilman Greg Picklap is joining us today to let us know about the centennial celebration for the Boone County Courthouse, which will be held on Friday, May 4th. We'll wrap up with the Democratic Socialists of America Summit on Saturday, May 5th.
Well, that sounds like a pretty full slate today, Susan. We'd better get started.
Let's listen in as KHOI's nature reporter Pat Schlarbaum speaks with John Howe, director of the Raptor Resource Project, about the memorial to Decorah Dad.
Hello, John.
Hi. Hi, Pat.
Well, we've got some things occurring. The Decorah male, the dad, had disappeared possibly. Has it been 2 weeks now?
It'll have been 2 weeks since we've seen him. He took off for his roost that night, and we have not identified or seen him since. So, a few sightings of male eagles the following morning, but Right. We were never able to identify it as him.
So, in a sense, we're memorializing. After 2 weeks, the likelihood of that bird having a miraculous return is probably outside the realm of possibilities. What is an average lifespan of a bald eagle?
Well, I've heard in the wild all the way up to, around 40 years. And I think I just heard a couple weeks ago that there was an eagle that just made it up to in the 50 range.
Uh-huh.
I think it varies quite a bit. I remember thinking to myself about Decorah Dad just being there by the fish hatchery, depending on the type of life that they live, whether it's possibly, could it be if they live an easier life, easier to get food, less stress, that they might live a longer life, and I'm not sure about that. We were thinking that he was probably around 21. So on that range, getting up there, but certainly not the oldest that folks have monitored eagles out in the wild.
Sure, and it is quite an accomplishment to even attain adult status, where bald eagles, the first 5 years, essentially preparatory to successfully nesting at year five and then beyond. And it is known that he had other mates earlier. I think the current mate appeared in 2007.
Right.
And this would be a good point for people that want the background of this bird, recommend watching The American Eagle, a production by Neil Rettig, one of your board members.
That's an amazing movie, and that really was the start. Neil filming that movie, and they located the nest down there in Decorah. And after that first year of 2007, start of filming, you're right. We had a change in partners there. The female that Dad Decora was hooked up with basically went missing after a late winter, early spring snowstorm. You know, kind of interesting, some of the similarities here. With the disappearance of Dad after a snowstorm. But that happened, and then the following year they decided to put the Nest Cams up and really bring that out to the public. So many people were coming by while they're doing that filming and asking about the eagles. Very interesting how that change happened about 2007 with the current female, Mom Decora. And Dad, you know, we were guessing he was probably 5-plus years older than her at that time period, just by guessing on stories about what had happened in the valley there. So now we're dealing with a situation where after a late season snowstorm, Dad Decora goes missing, and now we're left with the female. We know she's younger than him. And I guess, you know, looking on the positive side of that, Pat, it's like, well, at least we're having a shift change or a partner change here. You know, while Mom Decora is still a little bit further down on the time age scale continuum here. And, you know, if she does pick up a new mate, which it looks like that is in progress, that there's a little bit of an offset there. You're not getting two eagles same age, both old, you know. Right. There's things that we saw that were taught there, right, in a certain way, like here's where the food supply is over by that fish hatchery, right? Yeah.
Well, I think it's good to point out people always want to assert that eagles mate for life, whereas the life of either one of the nesting pair, they sure do bond or stay together at their territories. It's they seem to kind of – and maybe a way of saying that they mate to the territory as long as either one is living. And if it's staggered like it is, then the territory does – go on. And we're memorializing the Decora dad on Wednesday. Could you give us a few details on what people might do to recognize this?
Yeah, so I guess from my understanding, our Raptor Resource Project Facebook page, they're going to open that up for people to post favorite photos or, you know, just tributes or stories that they've got. There's such a rich history of people who've come to Decora, kind of their mecca of bald eagles. It's kind of funny, you know, folks have mentioned before. It's like I passed four states and 25 eagle nests, you know, on my way to go to Decora to see this one eagle pair. But just the whole history and the popularity and what people have had invested in watching and becoming familiarized with these eagles. And It looks like Dad Decora is gone. You know, to the best we can tell, you know, we haven't seen him for 2 weeks. So we're just saying, hey, you know, we're rounding the corner here. This looks like the new normal. We're not erasing the possibility, and we have no control over this anyway. We're not erasing the possibility that something could happen and he might be recuperating and come back and fight for the territory. Who knows about that? But we want to memorialize and just have a tribute to what an amazing bald eagle we got to watch and love and get to know over the last 10 years. And like I said, I think the main conduit is going to be through our online moderated chat on our website and through our Facebook page.
Fantastic. I noticed there was some observation yesterday. There has been an unidentified male eagle that has been in the vicinity. I noticed one of the posts yesterday that now there are two nests, which eagles quite often will build a second nest. And it was the original that the pair was sighted, which ironically would be where everything kind of got started with the original mom and dad. And now we have an unidentified male that's probably, you know, has white head, so he's 5 years old and looking for a territory. That just has a female who seems to be calling for eagles when she directs her beak straight up in the air, and it's quite a how would you describe that call that she emits?
It's pretty interesting. I'm not even going to attempt to do it with my own voice.
Well, I'm not putting you on the spot or anything, but
yeah. Chortling.
Chortling. I like that.
But sure. It's striking. You can tell, and it's pretty characteristic of the eagles when they see another eagle or bird of prey coming through the territory. It's their warning.
Yeah.
And I think what happened that first day afterwards on Thursday, almost 2 weeks ago, there was an eagle that did show up, and we identified it as a male, and we weren't quite sure, you know, is this Dad Decora, something happening where he's not behaving like we would expect him to,
right.
You know, down on the nest. And Mom wasn't treating this eagle the same way either. It was not clear whether or not she was warning him or warning other eagles away, but I think we all assume, since this was such an abrupt change and a new eagle there, that she was warning him away from the nest, and she was not familiarized with him like she was with Dad Decora. So over the last almost 2 weeks, there's been a normalization get-to-know-you period with this unnamed male eagle, and I guess some people are even starting to say Umi, you know?
Oh, Umi,
everybody
yeah.
wants to call the eagle a name. But,
oh, U-M-E, yeah.
Yeah, it's kind of hard to, it almost sounds like a name for a man, remotely manned vehicle or something. But so this unnamed eagle or unknown eagle really has been making inways with getting closer to the nest, getting closer to Mom Decora. They've been flying up and soaring together. She takes off after him when he leaves, and he follows her when she flies off. We've seen them perching together on the westernmost tree there by the nest, and you mentioned possibly N1 yesterday. I didn't hear about that one yet, but I know I did see them. They were both perched over in the maple tree, which is a favorite perch of Mom and Dad Decora, kind of watching over those pools with the trout and the overflow pond there where they go fishing, you know, pretty frequently. And since Dad Decora has his absence, primarily the food that's been coming up into the nest has been trout. So she is apparently going for the easiest catch that she can get. And that's probably just, you know, not having the time that she used to have with a mate on the nest, you know, taking care of the young. She has not let that male on or near the nest, although he's in defense. One day, I think it was Saturday this last week, there was another eagle that came through. We were guessing it was a male, and it was a windy day again too, where there's a lot of flight going on those days. It actually swooped over the nest. You could see the shadow of it, and he was calling out after it and warning it, and then he made a flight kind of hovering right over Mom and the three eaglets, almost like in a defensive posture. And then he went off after that, and boots on the ground, a couple viewers that we know of that were there actually reported that the two males, we assume, locked talons. They kind of went down into the ground in the field up to the north of the nest. And then the female Mom Decora came over there, and she was checking things out. And then that unidentified male chased that other eagle out of the area. So there's been some very interesting, I guess I'd call it research. We've never seen this happen before with this nest, and we haven't seen it happen a whole lot on or other cameras across the country. You know, just researchers talking about this stuff happens, but now we're getting to see it in pretty good detail.
Right, exactly. There are other eagle nests that have been studied. You wouldn't necessarily have that positive ID of the existing pair from repeated observations from the cameras. And they and you kind of know who is who, which is somewhat remarkable in itself.
And so I think you were kind of alluding to, and something that we've thought about and people have mentioned, it's like, well, my gosh, what if this could be Dad Decora trying to make it back to the territory, and he's being fought off by this possibly younger eagle or you know, whatever age level eagle he is, but he's helping, he's defending, he's getting more familiarized, and Mom Decora is becoming more accepting of him and treating him like a known partner, not necessarily in all ways, but in many ways. We do have some pretty good photos of the third eagle And, you know, folks and myself, the others that have looked at it, you know, we don't think that it's dad Decorah based just on the behaviors. We really want to just get together and talk about and share stories about this amazing eagle that we've been watching for over 10 years now. And I was thinking about it myself, so I know that the feelings that I'm experiencing are very similar to others, but I was realizing the other day, being a cam operator and helping, you know, upgrade the HD cameras and then manning those cameras and training, you know, others to help out with that, really been watching this eagle for a good chunk of my life for the last 3 years, and I can honestly say that I probably seen more of this eagle than I probably have of any family member, even my wife. So you watch something, an incredible creature, bald eagle like Dad Decorah, and get to know, you know, all their little behaviors and funny things that they do and just amazing things that they do, rearing their young and fending the territory and all that. And it's hard not to have a deep connection and admiration for Dad Decorah. I know I do, and so many others do. It's almost like this is the time to at least celebrate and remember, you know, what we love about him, and some of that is still in the present. Those
sure enough
don't just go away over day. It's almost like losing, you know, a very, very close pet or almost even a family member.
Exactly. And his progeny, up to 31 that were documented, probably a few years previous to that.
Right.
It's possibly the most famous eagle in the universe. And what a great setting. And if people do drive up there, I have to say it's quite uplifting to see the Decorah eagle nest at the fish hatchery and then enjoy the Decorah community. It's really quite a remarkable gift that the Raptor Resource Project is sharing with us. And thank you for keeping this story so viable and so interesting and so meaningful.
Hey, you're welcome, Pat. And I definitely want to extend a thank you out to Willard and Mary Ellen Holthaus and the other landowners in the area that also, you know, are so gracious with their love of the eagles and watching it and letting us do our equipment and broadcast and stuff like that through their home territory.
Yeah.
So very much appreciative of that, and also just the care and the support from all the listeners and viewers that watch and love the Decorah Eagles.
Yeah, thank you, John Howe. Yeah, it's quite a story, quite an unfolding story. There's more to come. It'll sure be wonderful to see, and we'll keep our fingers crossed. But then in the autumn, next October, that will be the time that will this nest persevere and go on. And if anything that can be assured, the Raptor Resource Project will be pulling right alongside Bob Anderson's vision and dream. And it's just quite a wonderful thing, John.
Yeah, we'll be watching. We'll continue the educational chat with the classrooms and just the general public and watch that story unfold. It's great to be able to tell that, and thanks for sharing that with your listeners, right?
Right. Okay. Thank you.
Sounds good, Pat. It's pretty exciting, a mile a minute here, just watching and hearing what's going on. So,
well, you've sure been courteous and liberal with your time. Thanks, John.
Thanks, Pat.
Yep. We'll
Bye.
See you.
Well, in case you just tuned in, this is KHOI Community Radio 89.1, Story City and surrounding area, Ames. And we've been listening to Pat Schlorbaum, our nature reporter, talking today about today's memorial for Decorah Dad, the world-famous father of the Decorah Eagles.
Those of you who've been reading seed catalogs or who may be anxiously awaiting the day when you can plant something may be interested in the opening of Red Granite Farm east of Boone tomorrow, May 3rd. I thought it would be a great excuse to take a drive in the country with my husband, Fritz. And I understand that Paul, who usually is my companion for road trips, was jealous when he found out that we went to Red Granite Farm. Do you want to tell him?
Yeah, I know that family. They're right on the edge of the Roland Story School District. Their son, Gabe, is enrolled at the elementary school where I volunteer. So I know Gabe, and I know the family, and I know the enterprise. And I heard a lot about it, and I've seen them at farmers markets, but I didn't get to their farm.
So now you can hear about it. I got there, and I found Nicole Jonas setting out plants for the opening event on May 3rd.
We moved here in 2007 and promptly planted an acre of vegetables and started selling at the farmers market. And then in 2011, I quit my job and started growing the perennials. And the garden center opened, I think, in the fall of 2012. So we used to haul them all to the farmers market, and now we've realized that's a lot of work. So we like people to come to us. You can see a lot more of what we have to offer here at the farm.
I first knew you from the farmers market. Are you not going to be there anymore?
We do go to the farmers market. We'll be at the Ames Main Street Farmers Market starting sometime mid-June. We don't grow a lot of early spring vegetables. We grow more like broccolis, cauliflowers, cabbages to get our season started. So we're focusing on being open here at the farm for the garden center in the months of May and June, but then we will be back at the farmers market downtown Ames on Saturday mornings. We will have all the same things we've always had: cucumbers, zucchinis, tomatoes, cauliflowers, broccoli, sweet corn, pumpkins in the fall. Yes, we have about 3 acres of vegetables we grow here along with the garden center.
Well, I remember you're having plants at the North Grand Farmers Market. Are you not going to bring those in now?
No, we just do the downtown Ames Farmers Market now, and the plants stay home most weekends. Sometimes we're able to bring them maybe once in May and maybe once in June, but we don't have a very large staff, so we like the customers to come to us now. It's a nice drive out to the country, and we have about an acre of display beds, so you can see a lot of the things that we sell growing right here at the farm and get an idea of what they're going to look like in your landscape someday.
I noticed that you had a degree in horticulture. Did you have that in mind when you bought the farm, that you were going to be able to use your training?
Of course. My husband and I both graduated in horticulture, and his emphasis was in fruit and vegetable production, which is why we grow all the vegetables for the farmers market. He loves to grow things, loves to grow food and share it with the community. And then ornamental horticulture was my focus. So I really like growing perennials and designing landscapes for people who want to do it yourself and install their own plantings. So we don't have a landscape crew, but we do offer consulting services where we sell a lot of our perennials and shrubs and such.
On your website, I saw that you had bought a Century Farm. Is it the original whole Century Farm, and how large is it?
It is not. We were only able to purchase 5 acres here, but yes, it was a Century Farm in the Moeller family. And that family, some of them live in Boone still, but some of them live in other parts of the country. And when they come back to visit, they like to see what we've done with the place. So just 5 acres here to grow on and to raise our children on. But coming from a regular conventional corn, soybeans, pigs and cow background, it's a little different. It's not quite the same as a farm I grew up on, but it's a great way to raise our kids.
Do your kids have chores?
Of course. Our kids are 12, 10, and 7, and we have a flock of 400 laying hens and 400 babies right now. So they're always helping fill the feeders, gather eggs, and they have a few bottle calves that they show at the fair too. So there's always something for them to do.
But they don't work in the garden.
Oh, they do that too. My youngest especially is excited to grow radishes for the farmer's market. So, yeah, my daughter helps every Saturday morning at the farmer's market. She'll be there counting your money and adding up your vegetables and things. And then my son Gabriel likes to help out driving the gator around, collecting things and helping go for this and go for that. So, yep, Claire, Gabe, and Nolan are very involved in the farm.
And from your website, which incidentally I recommend because you have the prices on your perennials, you have what you are growing, what people can see if they come out. You also have vintage goods.
Yes, our vintage vendors will be setting up on Thursday evening, and they will be here Friday, Saturday, and Sunday. This weekend is our opening for the season at the Garden Center, and our vintage vendors bring a lot of fun things like old chairs painted bright, fun colors for your garden, repurposed planters that you can plant annuals or succulents in. And then our other vendor has reclaimed barn wood that they paint on, and they're beautiful sunflowers and coneflowers and lily of the valley and all sorts of different spring inspiration for your home. Now, they also do summer, fall, and even winter scenes, and they'll probably bring a little bit of everything. Boone River Rustics comes from Webster City, and they're the artist.
When we drove away from the Red Granite Farm, we started to think about lunch, and I remembered the new barbecue restaurant I read about a couple of months ago just down Highway 17 in Luther. I thought our readers might be as curious as I was to find out how Whatcha Smokin' was getting along. They were pretty busy when we came in, but I managed to catch the eye of the owner, Tanya Doyle.
Yeah, so the story is amazing. I used to work in the food industry, but in manufacturing. And so a previous quality team member, continuous improvement, and so I retired back in April, and my partner Steve and I have always had a dream to have our own sit-down restaurant. And so for a couple years, we were building our model and our strategy and what we wanted to do. And I worked a lot in Chicago and Rochester, New York, and in Italy. So a lot of what I experienced in restaurants, we brought back here because we are a split strategy. We don't have just barbecue. We also have a make-your-own mac and cheese that's from a restaurant that's in Wrigleyville in Chicago. And we have, you know, a Frito pie that's from St. Louis. So we do a lot of research, too. We go to places that have good barbecue, and we see what they're doing right, and we take their ideas, and we come back here, and we make them ours, and, of course, we give them credit for it. But that's what we do. We were just in Austin, Texas, about 7 weeks ago for 4 days. So we go on trips all the time to do research. And so it's interesting because it's an unusual restaurant.
I had read about it. I was looking for it. We were out in the country, and we thought, oh, this is a good time to try the What You're Smoking.
It's where the old gas station used to be, because actually where the kitchen is used to be the old service station. And then we doubled the size of the building when we added this patio that we're sitting in here right now, and the open concept with the garage doors, that comes from a restaurant that I used to go to quite often in Rochester, New York. So, yeah, it's a cool, modern flair with Central Texas barbecue, and we make everything here homemade. We don't take anything out of a can and serve it. The only thing that is purchased and we do not make are the Wisconsin cheese curds, because we can't make them any better than they can.
Well, I think your decor is very interesting. In fact, when I first saw the what you call a patio, it looks like a garage. You have five garage doors. You can drive in and drive out.
That's correct. And it looks like you're in someone's garage. And so you feel comfortable. You're with family. You're with friends. It's a very relaxed atmosphere. We have a lot of memorabilia here from the 60s, the 70s, even modern stuff. My old beer sign collection is in here. If you walk around, you'll find a lot of my old beer signs. So, yeah, it's a cool atmosphere.
What is amazing is how people find you. We came by on a Tuesday morning at 11. And when we came in, they said, well, we can't talk to you right now because we're getting ready for the rush. And sure enough, a line was forming behind us as we spoke.
Yes, that's what happens. And I think some people get upset because since we are Texas style, that means that what we smoke that day, we serve fresh. And when we run out, we run out. If you hear us use the term 86, that means that we've just sold the last order. And that is the style in Texas. So we will not reheat meat and serve it to you the next day. There's not even a microwave on this property. So any meat that's left over gets used immediately the next day in one of our signature sandwiches, which is our barbecue cheesesteak, which is our Philly. So that's something that people need to understand and get used to, I think, around here, because if they come to dinner at 7 or 8 at night and they're expecting us to still have our meats, a lot of times we don't, because they've stormed us early and we're out. And we continually increase our quantities, but overnight, virtually in the last 3 weeks, we've probably doubled our business just because of the warm weather.
About how many people do you serve in a day?
You know, I would say In the beginning of the week, we're probably at around 150, and on the weekends, we get close to 600 to 700.
In Luther, Iowa.
Yes, in Luther, Iowa. We are in the middle of nowhere. And we also have a motorcycle shop here that I own, too. So I'm very much into vintage motorcycles. And so it's kind of an eclectic area because, honestly, the people that come here to the restaurant, they're going to the Arboretum. They're going to the Ledges State Park. They're going to the bike trail, the High Trestle Trail. They're riding their motorcycle by. They're going to Boone to go to the Junkin stores. They're going to Boone to ride the train. You know, there's so much in this area for people to do that it just fits that they have somewhere really nice to come and sit down and have something really good to eat and relax and have a drink with their friends.
And your name is?
Tanya Doyle, and my business partner is Stephen Perlowski.
You've been listening to Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio, where we explore the people, stories, and events in Central Iowa. Paul Wearson and I are your hosts for today, and you've just heard about a couple of interesting places to visit in rural Boone County. Nicole Jonas told the story of Red Granite Farm, and Tanya Doyle described the secrets of success of Whatcha Smokin', the Texas barbecue restaurant by the side of the road in Luther.
Well, it's time now to go to the city of Boone, where they're going to be holding a 100th anniversary celebration for the Boone County Courthouse. And we have local history buff and Boone City Councilman Greg Picklap on the phone to tell us what it's all about. Hi, Greg.
Hi, how are you doing?
I really hope I did your last name right.
It's just like it looks, right on the paper right there, so you got it perfect.
Thank you. Now tell me about the celebration going on here on May 1st, I believe, huh? That was a dedication date, I guess, originally.
Our celebration is going to happen on May 4th, starting at 1 o'clock in the afternoon on the north side of the courthouse grounds here in Boone, City of Boone and Boone County. May 1st was when the original dedication happened in 1918 for the cornerstone and everything else for the building when it was officially opened to the public. And it's really one of our crown jewels here for historic preservation and also pride in some of our government facilities.
No, it's a beautiful courthouse, but I've always wondered in my trips to Boone, the courthouse normally in Iowa towns is downtown right on the square. How did the Boone County Courthouse end up so far west in the city?
Well, here in Boone, we took a roundabout way to it. What is now considered the city of Boone actually started as two separate communities. Where the courthouse currently sits is the oldest section of Boone, which is used to be called Boonesboro, and it was the west side of Boone, and that's where the courthouse had always been in the previous buildings up until the current courthouse was laid. What happened was is that when the railroad came through, is that they put their downtown main stop line in what is now our current downtown city of Boone area. So there was actually two communities founded right next to each other, and eventually over the decades we just merged together to become what is now the city of Boone. So you are absolutely correct, where most communities have their downtown courthouse area and a plaza and set up around the downtown Main Street area. We actually have a Main Street area where our city hall currently is, and then we also have our courthouse, which is West Boone, which also has buildings and currently our law enforcement center next to it.
Well, you know, you've answered a question I've had all my life because I always wondered why the courthouse was so far west. And thank you, Greg. You've corrected.
I'm happy to do it.
You're also on the National Historic Register of Historic Places. Now, I guess that's quite a process. How long have you had – when did you do that, and what's involved in registering as a National Historic Place?
Going through the process is extensive. It's research and everything else, and then also too, it's also it's a commitment on the community itself because the building has to maintain the status as well to maintain the dedication. So our building, the courthouse, was registered with the National Register of Historic Places on July 2nd, 1981. And if you look at it that way, we are even almost past. We are past 30-plus years right there, so we are already committed almost towards half the lifespan of the courthouse as a National Register of Historic Places. We have to maintain it historically. We have to maintain the historical preview of it. We also have to maintain also updating the building and making sure it can service the community as the county courthouse here in the 21st century.
Hey, that's terrific. Now, the actual commemoration event, you tell us about what's going to happen there.
Well, on May 4th, what we're going to have is a dedication ceremony, and we have local representatives, Chairman County Supervisor Steve Duffy is going to speak, former County Supervisor and current State Senator Jerry Bain will speak. There'll be a rededication of the building by local Mason chapters, including the one that originally helped do the dedication back in 1918. And then also as well, there'll be tours. The county courthouse will be closed down during the ceremony, so they'll be available for tours and looking at the different historical artifacts laid out, and also refreshments as well.
Now, refresh our memory for everybody. I want you to be able to promote that event. It'll be May 2nd, right?
May 4th.
May 4th, I'm sorry.
Nope.
And what time are you having that?
Everything starts at 1 o'clock on the dot. So we will have seating set up outside. State Street, which is the east side of the street along the courthouse, will be closed. We'll have that set up for historical cars and vehicles. And then also handicap parking will be accessible on the south side on what is 2nd Street of the courthouse. And then also, too, as well, we'll have the planning on having school tours and everything else go through today and also all the way up to the 4th. So there'll be school buses coming in and out as well for tours for local schools.
Well, that's a real extensive event. And it's going to expose a lot of people of all ages to knowledge about the Boone County Courthouse, its background, and the wonderful building. You'll have a chance to see that. And will there be food, Greg?
There will be some snacks.
Food. There's going to be food.
There'll be food. So you definitely have to come out. There'll be refreshments and snacks and everything else. No charge. It'll just be free there for the public. Also, as part of the ceremony as well, they'll be able to get a tour of the buildings and see what the time capsule we are placing there for this ceremony, and then also to some of the historical things done at the courthouse, such as what we call the Wall of Honor, which was put up right after World War II by a local artist. And it's a list of every Boone County veteran and status from World War II on it.
Well, you know, these buildings in Iowa, whether you're talking about county courthouses or our marvelous state house in Des Moines, our wonderful ornate buildings that are dated in the early 20th century, and basically you're talking about beautiful architecture, a lot of marble and sandstone, and buildings can't be built that way anymore because of the expense. So we honor not only those beautiful buildings and what kind of an artifact they are for Iowa culture and history, but also we honor the whole idea of county government and the fact that we have local representation and people can go and do their business within one buggy ride of their house or farm. And so bless the Boone County Courthouse and all county courthouses. And, Greg, once again, May 4th, what time?
1 o'clock in the afternoon is the start of our ceremony and should be done by 5.
That is fantastic. And thank you very much, Greg.
My pleasure. Thank you.
That was Greg Picklap, City Councilman of Boone. And to cap off the events of this week, we have Evan Berger to tell us about the Iowa Democratic Socialists of America Summit, to be held Saturday, May 5th at the Unitarian Universalist Fellowship of Ames, 1050 North Highland, from 10 a.m. to 4 p.m.
Now, I am really a student here because I have not been familiar with the Democratic Socialists at all, Susan.
That's why you're the ideal person to ask the questions.
Well, very good. Evan, pleasure to have you here.
Thanks for having me on.
And we better start with the beginning since I am demonstrating my own ignorance. Okay. What kind of an organization is Democratic Socialists of America?
Yeah, so the short version is we're the largest socialist organization in the United States. Our purpose is to build a movement for socialism, as we define it.
And so the purpose is to build a movement for socialism. What are the major issues of concern for your organization? What's the motive for, and what sort of things do people get behind if they're a part of this organization?
Yeah, definitely. So everything we do, again, is, you know, kind of taking on, we see capitalism as the problem behind all these different issues that we work on. And so that's the kind of common thread that ties everything together. But specifically, the three campaigns that the national organization is running right now are a campaign for Medicare for All. We think that healthcare is one field where the capitalist system is clearly failing and people are dying because of it. And we need universal health care. The second campaign is labor solidarity. We know that we need strong unions if we're ever going to win anything in this country. And the last one is building electoral power, independent electoral power, and electing some candidates who share these values.
So you're not really going to be a political party as such and run candidates. You are an organization that advocates certain views and certain things that you want to transpire or happen or change. Is that right?
Exactly right. So, we, like I said, we care about building electoral power, but we want to build electoral power that's independent of existing political parties. Again, when we go back to our core purpose of building that movement, we think that movements are how social change happens, that it's about people out in the street organizing day in and day out, and that candidates are kind of an expression of that movement. So we got to build the movement first, and then, yeah, we need the candidates too, but they're kind of secondary to our concerns.
Now, in your organization right now, how many folks are actively participating? What's the size of this movement? Give us a feeling for
yeah.
that.
Yeah. So I don't have the current membership numbers for the national organization, but I want to say it's, 8,000 to 10,000, something like that. Again, the largest socialist organization in the United States. Here in Ames, the Heart of Iowa chapter is what we call ourselves. There's about 20 people who are actively engaged. And then, like Susan said, we're hosting a statewide event this weekend, and we're expecting about 100 people for that.
Okay. Now, the statewide event will be held where?
At the Unitarian Universalist Fellowship here in Ames this Saturday, May 5th at 10 a.m. Registration starts at 9:30.
And so you hope for people coming from throughout the state to be here at the Unitarian building in Ames.
Yes. Yeah.
And you're getting ready for that. That'll be this weekend.
Exactly. So that's been our big, focus, a lot of work going into it. The RSVPs are looking really good. I think we're going to fill that place up.
So now how does this fit into the existing partisan network? We are a two-party country. We have the Democrats and the Republicans. And how does this organization hope to actually have an influence on electoral outcomes?
Yeah, so this is a robust discussion within the organization, for sure.
Oh, yeah.
I think, one thing that everyone agrees on is that, again, this movement building piece where we got to build a movement. But then how does that specifically relate to the Democratic Party, for instance, is a topic of conversation. I think there are people within DSA who think that there's value in building power within the Democratic Party, running for an internal Democratic Party position. Some people say we don't want to get caught up in any of that at all. We just got to do our own thing and keep organizing outside of the Democratic Party. And I think, one thing I enjoy about DSA is it is what we call a multi-tendency organization. So there's not like a party line that you have to follow in order to be a member. It is actually a place for debate and for hashing out some of these questions. And that's what the summit this Saturday is really all about, is bringing together people from across the state who are not just people who are already involved in DSA, but anyone who's interested in socialism, interested in talking about these issues.
And so you're not really building a political party here.
Exactly.
You're talking about an organization that's in a position to advocate for certain policies or methods of governing or providing services for people. And we're talking here about really an upcoming election year where we have the midterms mm-hmm. coming up. What sort of role do you anticipate your organization playing in the upcoming election campaigns now in November?
Yeah. So for both the elections in June, the primary elections in June and the general election in November, a lot of our members are involved in different campaigns. And as individuals, but organizationally, we're kind of staying out of it. And just kind of on the broader question of elections, I'm a lifelong Iowan, born and raised here. And I think it's great that we have the First of the Nation caucus. But I do think that one thing, especially here in Iowa, that happens is electoral politics kind of sucks up all the oxygen in the room. So every 4 years, we have this enormous, millions of dollars operations coming in. And that's all everyone talks about, and that's all that politics is for that year or so. And we're about to get into another round of that. And I think that's all well and good, and I appreciate that we have a big voice in that process. But I do think that means that there's not as much of a focus on building organizations that will be around for the long term. You know, political campaigns are great, but the day after election day or if the day after caucus day, they disappear and all that infrastructure that was built up kind of goes into the ether. So I think that's one reason in a local context why it's important, or why I appreciate this thinking about building power outside of electoral politics, is because that's one flaw that I've seen.
That's interesting. Building power outside the electoral existing parties.
Yeah.
So from what I'm hearing you say, you expect and hope that people who are affiliated with your organization will act as individuals to go out there and advocate for certain policies and maybe certain candidates. Now, does your organization endorse candidates?
Yeah. So our chapter just passed our bylaws just this last winter. And so the way we kind of settled on for endorsements is that we want to have kind of a supermajority of members who are supporting a given candidate. So, you know, we'll take a vote on endorsement, and 2/3 of our members need to support that candidate. And at the national level, they have even a more stringent requirement for which candidates they endorse, which is that candidate has to openly identify as a socialist. So, for instance, Bernie Sanders, you know, was a candidate who says, yes, I'm a democratic socialist. And that that's kind of what DSA National looks for when they're looking at which candidates to endorse. And I think the reason for that is part of the battle is breaking these stigmas around socialism. Socialism is a dirty word, or has been a dirty word for so long in America.
Well, yeah, that's – I really want to attend to that.
Sure.
Because – yes, you just said something that I think is key to what the general public is likely to think. You probably have some pushback when they hear that word. It's, you know, it's a loaded term because it's been politicized and used in a very degrading way by a lot of people who are on the right side of politics, the right wing.
Yeah.
And so it can really be an incendiary word. How do you deal with that?
Yeah, so I mean, I think we take it head on. It's not like we're hiding the fact that we're socialists. It's right in the name. And I think, you know, for us, you know, socialism is about democracy. It's about true democracy in politics, but even more importantly, it's about democracy in the workplace and in our economy. So we know that if we can't have a true democracy in a political sense unless you have some sort of say in your own workplace. And we see that with things like money and politics, where when we have an economy that allows a few people to build up these massive sums of wealth, they're able to influence politics in a way that's detrimental to the vast majority of people, just because of the, you know, no matter what kind of campaign finance laws we throw up there, they're going to have this huge outsized voice in our political system. And when we look at things like, you know, so say, you know, for the average person who's going into work for 8 hours a day, you know, it's great to have, you know, freedoms and liberties outside of those 8 hours. But we also need to have freedoms and liberties and some sort of say in your workplace during those 8 hours, too. And that's where we spend, you know, the majority of our waking hours. So that's what, when I talk about socialism, and that's what I come back to, is this idea of democracy. And again, that's in our name, Democratic Socialists of America. But actually, this Saturday, one of the workshops is how to talk about socialism. So anyone who's interested in this is like, well, this stuff all sounds great, but this socialism word is turning me off. That's, you know, one of the goals of this weekend's event.
So to get past the incendiary impact of the word socialist in America, it's better to focus on what the world would look like if some of the things you advocate for were actually employed in our country. What would life be like if labor had more power?
Exactly.
If there was universal health care coverage? What would life be like if there were some counterforce to the actual weight of money in large corporations?
Yeah.
And so this is really the world that you aspire to. So if you focus on things like that, for instance, you know, I'm 75,
uh-huh.
So I grew up when labor had a lot more power,
right.
And sometimes that was excessive. I remember when I was a boy, the longshoremen shut down the entire eastern seaboard,
yeah.
You know, and so there was a big power space there maturing after World War II, when we were the manufacturer for the world, and a person with a high school diploma could have a union job with full benefits, and We all know what's happened since 1980 to erode that position, and the power of the unions to strike is diminished by the option of management to move jobs overseas. Mm-hmm. And so that's disarmed labor to a large degree. Plus, the government has, to some degree, some administrations have been actively involved in opposing the labor movement. And so that's a new framework to operate in, where reality is that the power to strike has been diminished. So how does labor assert itself without the power to strike?
Well, it's interesting because I think a lot of workers still do have the power to strike. And I look at places like West Virginia, the teachers strike, where, you know, legally speaking, they couldn't strike. But that's the beauty of striking is if you're a worker, you can withhold your labor, and there are going to be there can be legal protections for that, right? Or it can be more difficult. But that's the one thing that you can always do is say, no, I will not, you know, say to your employer, you need my labor. I'm choosing not to give it to you until you meet my conditions. And we definitely need to work in the electoral arena to make sure that there are more protections for that, right? But one thing I've been excited about just over the last few months is these teacher strikes where, you know, like here in Iowa, they're technically illegal. It's illegal for teachers to strike. But teachers are, as workers, are saying we're gonna exercise our power as workers and exercise our power to create better learning conditions for our students regardless. This is too important, and we've been stomped on for too long. So
well, that's I know that one private sector area where strike would still be a feasible solution or strategy, you know, is really involved in jobs that can't be transplanted. Mm-hmm. I'm thinking of the hospitality industry, hotels, restaurants, the workers in these areas.
Airports.
Probably they have a leverage to strike because their job can't be exported.
Mm-hmm.
So, and as a historian, and I'm a big history buff, of course, history shows that the pendulum goes so far one way, and then it swings back.
Right.
You know, and so you had the Gilded Age back in the late 19th century and the robber barons and all this, which we're sort of reliving again. And then you have to counter for that the labor movement of the mm-hmm. early 20th century, all the reforms of the Roosevelt administration, and then Reagan has switched back. The pendulum swings back. And by my view as a historian currently, the pendulum has swung so much this way that it's going to begin swinging the other way. And your movement and people who think as you do, whether they be socialists or not, might be intervening at a time favorable to you in the history of our country, our labor movement. And people are really panicking, and justifiably so, about the health care. I just read on the internet that the World Health Organization ranks American health care 37th in the world, and that's because we don't have any universal coverage like other nations do. We're the only developed nation where there is not that sort of thing, and that's just a historical fact. That's not a political statement.
Mm-hmm.
And so if you are on the side of remedying that, the forces of history and the pendulum I spoke of might be favoring a lot of the things that you advocate, okay? So once again, before we close today, I want you to be able to tell everybody about what's going to happen, where, and when.
Yes, excellent. So what's going to happen is the 2018 Iowa Socialist Summit. When is this Saturday, May 5th, starting at, we'll say, 9:30. That's when registration opens. And where is the Unitarian Universalist Fellowship of Ames? This is an event, you know, we've got a keynote speaker lined up, Tony Smith. He's a professor at Iowa State University, talking about, you know, Karl Marx. One thing we didn't mention is that this event falls on Karl Marx's 200th birthday. So Marx wasn't right about everything, but Tony's going to be talking about ways that he is still so relevant for our time. We've got workshops. We've got social time. You'll be able to meet like-minded people from across the state. And then you'll also be hearing report backs from the different DSA chapters across the state. There's five.
This is wonderful. Evan Berger, thank you for being here. He's representing the Democratic Socialists of America. Their meeting coming up this weekend at
Unitarian Universalist Fellowship of Ames, 1050 North Highland.
Okay, and it's on Highland. Okay, thanks a lot, Evan.
Thank you.
You've been listening to Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio, where we explore the people, stories, and events in central Iowa. Paul Wearson and I, Susan Franzen, have been your hosts for today. Other voices you heard were Pat Schlarbaum, John Howe, Nicole Jonas, Tanya Doyle, Greg Picklap, and Evan Berger.
Now, you can listen to today's local talk show on any of our local talk shows, also online at our website, khoifm.org. There you will find information about our guests along with relevant links to today's stories. And remember, that's khoifm.org. And you can like us on Facebook and get updates on all our show postings in your news feed.
Local Talk was engineered by Rebecca Reuter. Our theme song is Backtrackin' by Al Harris and Tom Richards from their CD, The Ballad of Kate Shelley.
Now remember, Local Talk is a radio production training workshop as well as a show, so if you would like to join the team as a reporter, contact us at 292-2878. That's 292-2878. Or contact us through our website, khoifm.org. That's also where you need to go to contact us if you decide to become a member or renew your membership. Do that today. Just look for the yellow donate button at that website.
If you enjoyed the show, tell your friends. Remember, your participation as listener and your generous contributions are what make KHOI meaningful and possible. Thanks for listening, and
see you again on the radio.
Thank you to Pat Brown, State Farm Insurance, for sponsoring KHOI. For more information, visit www.patbrownagency.net.